You're listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast from the Modern War Institute at West Point. I'm John Spencer, Chair of Urban Warfare Studies at MWI and host of this podcast. Today's guest on the podcast is Chief Superintendent Shlomi Shitrit. Shlomi is the Israeli police chief historian and a longtime friend of mine. I've visited many times in Israel, learning about the different missions of the police, and which is very unique in Israel. Excited to have him on the show to discuss not only Israel police, but the Israel police actions on October 7th and what was going on that day and some of the individual battles. Shlomi, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you, John, for having me.
Okay. So I thought we'd start with, I've had previous police chiefs and other things from the United States on the show, but I've never had an Israeli police nor somebody like you who has been my kind of mentor. I've been a student of learning about the police, to include walking with many elements of the police in Israel on operations and learning and visiting the police. But I was wondering if you can give the audience kind of an overview of what is the Israeli police, what are the different components and the size of it, because it's surprisingly not as big as I think people might think.
Yeah, of course. First of all, listeners should notice that the police in Israel is very different to the law enforcement organizations they are familiar with in the States. We have only one police organization in Israel. That's the INP, Israel National Police. It's responsible for the entire area of the state of Israel. We have in total about 35,000 officers serving a population of about 10 million civilians. The police divides the state of Israel into seven territorial districts. Each district has all the unit types that it needs to serve the population in the area. Rank-wise, the police is headed by a commissioner, which has a rank equivalent to that of an army lieutenant general, a three-star general, and every district is headed by a major general, a two-star. Within each district, we have sub-districts, and throughout Israel, we have 80 police stations. I would say they are the precincts in many U.S. Law enforcement organizations. Another thing to notice is that the Israel police is also responsible for internal security within the state of Israel, meaning that we're not only tasked with enforcing the law, serving the population, traffic control, public order, but also with countering terror attacks. And for that end, we have a specialized unit. It's called MAGAV, which is the Israeli acronym for Border Police, but I will be using the Hebrew name because the name Border Police is misleading, because MAGAV doesn't actually guard the border. This is a historic name. MAGAV has about 11,000 officers out of the 35,000 that we have throughout Israel. And when you visit Israel, it's very easy to make the distinction between the two forces, because regular police officers like myself, we wear dark blue uniform, while MAGAV officers wear green uniforms. So we call them the blue police and the green police, although again, we are both part of the same organization. In addition, every police officer in Israel, regardless of his role, regardless whether he is regular police or MAGAV, is proficient in basic counter-terrorist operation. That means that we all have to be proficient with the use of firearms and light assault rifles, and that we all have to be ready to be deployed for patrol, checkpoint duty, etc. This includes even me, okay? I'm a historian, our clerks, administrative staff, and so on. The regular police also has dedicated, I would say, internal security units, equivalent to the SWAT teams in the US, although not exactly the same. And although these units wear blue uniform and are part of the regular police, they are dedicated for internal security. MAGAV has many special counter-terror units. The best known one and probably one of the best units for that purpose in the world is YAMAM, Hebrew acronym for Special Police Unit, which specializes in hostage rescue and operations within highly contested areas.
And if listeners want to go back and listen to, just look at the Mother's Bus episode that we did with Major General Palid, which discussed like the creation of the YAMAM and the break of that mission from Surat McCall, from the army to the police, and then the details about YAMAM, which is one of the elite, really many of the close quarters battle drills that U.S. military and others use now, came from really the creation of YAMAM and developing specialized tactics for hostage rescue and other close quarters situations. But no, that was a great rundown. One thing that I found interesting before we switched to October 7th is when I interviewed a police chief here in the United States, we went through organization capabilities. One of the things was just response time, to basically call to response time. And I think it was you and I, what was that, years ago, I asked you about basically, and when I went to the training center, it was about Israeli police response time is not measured in minutes, it's measured in seconds, and how you have to carry your hat off duty, because like in Jerusalem, there's an event, any police will be expected to respond. So it's like it's really a response time, different expectation, I think.
Yes, absolutely, especially for terrorist incidents.
I just remember it vividly. You even showing me that not only do most off-duty policemen around the United States or law enforcement will have authorization to carry concealed weapons and everything, but you guys were that. You have to be able to distinguish yourself too, because there's such chaos and especially a terrorism activity.
Yes, also I would note that legally we are never off-duty.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. So October 7th, let's talk through the Gaza envelope, because I know there's some unique precinct, district, and kind of all, just security environment. We're talking southern Israel near the Gaza-Israel border. It's called the Gaza envelope. Can you walk me through like what is the police situation in the Gaza envelope?
Sure. First of all, we're talking about an area which is roughly 600 square kilometers large. It has about a population of about 350,000 people. One city, Ashkelon, which is about 10 kilometers north to the Gaza Strip. Three towns, Sderot, Netivot, and Ofakim. And about 80 rural communities, kibbutzim, socialist communes, and moshavim, which are more like agricultural communities. In addition, on the morning of October 7th, there was a very large music festival going on about 5 kilometers from the border of Gaza, the Nova Party. Police-wise, we have four police stations: Ashkelon, Sderot, Netivot, and Ofakim, in every major urban community. They are all part of the Southern District. Ashkelon and Sderot are part of the Lachish sub-district, and Netivot and Ofakim part of the Negev sub-district, but that's less important. And on the morning of October 7th, which was a Saturday and also a holiday, it was the Simchat Torah holiday, we had on duty in all four stations. We had 29 police officers, 13 special constables, which are civilian volunteers who assist the police. And in addition, we had at the Nova Festival 41 officers who were there in order to enforce the law, help with traffic direction, and counter any criminal activity that might be there. Now, one thing to note about the Gaza periphery zone is that responsibility for counterterrorism and internal security in that area is the military, it's not the police. Because of the military responsibility to defend the border, it has a jurisdiction over most of the area inside Israel, only for internal security duties. It doesn't mean that the police doesn't operate in that area. We operate there freely, but only in our capacity as law enforcers, not for internal security. This means that, say that there is a suspected terrorist incursion into one of the communities in the area, the army is responsible to respond and the police would assist it and will operate under military command.
On that, we talked about the different community, we call them something different, like neighborhood watches. Many of the kibbutzims have security, I don't know what the name for them are.
Yeah, what we have in every, today it's in every Israeli community, but until October 7th, in every community which was in an area close to the border or close to, I would say, areas that are at high risk of being attacked by terrorists, we call them standby squads, kitot konenut in Hebrew. These are Israeli civilians who are armed and trained by either the army or the police, depending on where they are. And they are basically the first responders for a terrorist incursion. And I think that the best way to think about them for an American audience would be as the Minutemen from the colonial times, because that's exactly what they are. They are the ones who are supposed to be the first to respond to any attack on the community and hold the line until the military or the police arrive.
They fall under the police or the military. I think you said the military set the weapons policies and things like that because it's in the periphery zone.
Exactly. Now, in addition to the officers that I mentioned, Magav, the border police, also had 41 officers in the area under the command of the Southern District. So in total, we're talking about 110 police officers on that Saturday morning.
Okay. That's an amazing breakthrough. Thank you. You and I, we interviewed actually one of the police chiefs who was in charge of the Nova Music Festival, but I really wanted to start with the Battle of Sarok Police Station because it was very unique on the situation that quickly came to be there. You want to walk us through what happened at the Sarok Police Station?
Yeah, so Sderot is the Israeli town closest to Gaza. It's just outside, I would say, northeastern border with the Gaza Strip. And due to its vicinity to Gaza, it had been continuously attacked since 2006, 2007, first by rockets, mortar shells, and on October 7th, was one of the first places into which Hamas arrived. So at about, say, 7 a.m. or even earlier, some pickup trucks carrying terrorists entered Sderot very quickly.
So I think the rockets are 6:30, right? The first rockets?
6:30, yeah. 6:29, they begin. Yeah, and very, very early on. I mean, I think even before 7 a.m., three pickup trucks with the terrorist enters the road. Another one gets to a major junction south of the road called Shar HaNegev, Negev's Gate, and the terrorists set up an ambush there. And those in the road, they begin by driving through the city, massacring civilians. And at about 7 a.m., they get to the police station, which was their primary target. And I would say about a platoon-sized terrorist unit, arrive to the station. They shoot RPG rockets into the station. They kill some of the officers and they storm the station. Some of the officers are killed fighting in the ground level. Another seven officers and a civilian security guard escape to the roof and barricade themselves on the roof and begin fighting the terrorists to try to break out to the station's roof to kill them. The commander of the chief duty officer, Superintendent Mali Shoshana, she and her colleagues actually held the line on the roof for hours. She told us that when they ran out of ammo, they took ammunition from the bodies of terrorists that they killed. In one occasion, she succeeded in throwing back a hand grenade, which terrorists threw at her. And eventually, of those eight people on the roof, two police officers were killed and another five were severely wounded. They remained there for hours. Luckily for them, very, very quickly, about a few minutes later, the first response team, improvised response team, arrives on the scene. Now, what happened was that the district commander, Major General Amir Cohen, lives in Sderot, and he actually became a district commander 3 months earlier, and he moved to Sderot following this. And that morning, when he woke up like every other Israeli with the sirens due to the rocket attacks, he got a report that there is also there are speedboats sailing north of Gaza towards Ashkelon, and he understood that there is probably some kind of a wider attack than just a local incursion or rocket attack. So he gave the order to carry out a contingency plan that we had for such an occasion, and he got into his car and set out to Ashkelon. And just as he was driving out of Sderot, he began hearing small arms fire, which understood was not ordinary. And he saw a civilian running and signaling to him. And when he began talking with that civilian, he found out that this man was actually a imam, a sniper, who was in the synagogue. He was on the holiday with his family in Sderot and off duty, of course. And he called Major General Cohen and told him, "Sir, the station is being attacked." So they both drove to the station. They met there with police officers from the station who were on duty or off duty and arrived from home, with an Israeli army officer who arrived on the scene, with a soldier, with an armed civilian, and they all stormed the station. Again, this is minutes after terrorists took over the station. And this very, very quick response succeeded in containing the terrorists within the station. Now, they had no idea what was the size of the enemy within the station. They assumed that it wasn't more than a section, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 terrorists, because that's what we were always thinking about. No one imagined an invasion like the one that happened on October 7th morning. And at that time, Major General Cohen also had no idea of anything else happening besides the rockets attack and the speedboat incursion towards the north. So they fought there for about an hour. They suffered a few casualties. They neutralized some terrorists. And Major General Cohen called the head of the Magav in the Southern District to arrive. When that officer arrived, again, he arrived from home with another officer from another unit. He formed another ad hoc unit, 5 men in all, and they ran into the station. Because throughout the time they knew that there were police officers barricaded on the roof, they knew that they must get to them and rescue them before the terrorists kill them. And so they tried breaking in several times. The first force which tried breaking in got barricaded again inside the station in the stairwell. There were fired at from the top floor and from the cellar. The station had 2 stories, okay, the ground floor, the second floor, and also a cellar beneath that. And at about 10 a.m., a Yamam force arrived at the station. They succeeded in pulling out the officers barricaded at the stairwells, which some of them were wounded. Yamam also suffered some casualties during the rescue. And then they began to think how to get the officers off the roof. And as they understood that it was very, very difficult to break in through the entrance, they brought a fire engine with a crane, a cherry picker, I think it's called in the US. And they used that to get to the roof and to rescue the officers and the civilian who were on the roof. Then they tried to clear the station from above. Yamam operatives entered through the roof and they cleared the top floor. But when they tried to clear the ground floor, they encountered heavy fire again, suffered casualties, and they understood that the enemy force was far larger than anyone had expected. Now, this takes hours. I'm really running through, but they got the officers off the roof, I think, at about 2 or 3 p.m. They have been there for a few hours. Those officers, after they've run out of ammunition, they play dead. Some of the officers lost consciousness due to the wounds. So it was very, very long time for them to be on the roof. During that time, of course, Major General Cohen began receiving information on what was going on throughout the area and had to command the entire operation, the entire police response, while also taking notice of what's happening in Sderot, in the station where he was. By the way, he himself, like I said, participated in the combat. He assaulted terrorists with a gun. He was wounded, but he carried on commanding the forces throughout the day and after that.
Since you walked me through some of this, I just want to make sure that the interesting part of this is for the listeners. The police station is basically on the street, with the street running straight. Like, there's no separation really between the sidewalk street and the police station. It was seemed very close. There was a parking lot on the other side of the street, like a three-story apartment complex that overlooked the station. The station was fairly new, if I remember right.
Yeah, it was erected in
2012. Yeah, and it seemed like the picture you showed me before, a very strong-looking police station, two stories with a rooftop. How many people were working on the morning of October 7th in the building?
If I'm not mistaken, there were 10 officers because they were getting ready for the shift rotation.
Yeah.
Which was due at 7 a.m. So most of them were at the station.
Right. I actually have a little schematic here I drew when you walked me through this. I mean, this really very obvious police station, but the terrorists basically drive straight towards it. Three cars with what we now know is, I know you usually wait till the end, over 27 Hamas members, right?
Yeah, we recovered the bodies of 27 Hamas terrorists.
Yeah, but nobody knew that at the time that the battle's happening because they just ran straight to the police station, fired an RPG at the front door desk, basically, and then entered the police station where you're having these phases of the attack. And General Amir Cohen so that's like 7 that they attack it. He's there within minutes.
Yeah.
And you showed me actually where he had ricochet, where he was barricaded really on one, right before you get to the police station on the sidewalk behind like a trash can thing, and the bullets ricocheted off the wall and entered his back, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But he kept fighting through that, you know, orchestrating these next phases. So you have, when does there a Yamam shooter on the other side of the apartment complex engaging the terrorists in the building? Is that later or is that early in the morning?
No. He arrived there with Major General Cohen. He was the one calling him in.
Yeah, he went and sought high ground in the apartment complex on the other side. I just remember this because it's very vivid with iron sights.
With iron sights and with an M16 that he took off a soldier. It wasn't his personal weapons. Like I said, he was on off duty, on vacation with his family.
Yeah, and he's able to take some terrorists out with iron sights from the window across the street in an apartment complex. So that's 7:05. General Amir gets wounded, but is still commanding the Yamam forces in the fire truck. Then you said they tried using the fire truck. They tried what we call the squeegee technique, where the Yamam entered the roof and tried to go down, but they ran into a lot of Hamas, basically, because there's 25 in this small building trying to hold the door, right?
Yeah. Yamam, they laid the siege on the building.
Yes.
And in the afternoon, the late hours of that afternoon, the terrorists began trying to break out of the station. And then the police understood that there were many more terrorists inside than what we initially assessed.
Okay, so then what happens?
So what happens is that Yamam has been firing anti-tank rockets at the building.
Yeah, the Matador.
Matador, yeah. From the late morning in order to keep the terrorists' head down and to support their comrades on the roof. And after they have evacuated all the police officers and they also understood that there are many more terrorists than they thought and that any continued effort to clear the station would just cost us more casualties, they've decided to bring the building down. on top of the tourists. And the first one to call it was Yamam commander. He told his men on the ground that once they know that there are no more police officers in the building, that he gives them the permission to bring it down. And in the evening, the Yamam commander in Sderot asks Major General Cohen for permission to bring the station down on the tourists. And once General Cohen makes sure that not only the living police officers have been evacuated, but also the bodies of the fallen officers had been brought out of the building, he approves Yamam's request. And they bring a tank, a Merkava tank, to Sderot, which begins firing at the building. They bring an Apache gunship, which fires Hellfire missiles at the building, and they bring military bulldozers, who began also to break down the external walls of the building. And this takes several hours. During that time, terrorists try to break out of the building, but they are neutralized by Yamam forces around it. And only early morning on October 8th, the fighting is over. The station is mostly demolished, had burned down, and in total we've suffered 10 casualties in that battle.
So really interesting about the strength of the building. We just did an episode, two episodes ago, we talked about strong points for military in the cities. And one of the uniqueness that I, as an urban warfare guy, saw with this building, just how strong this building, this police station, how strong it was built within Sderot, that it was a strong point. It had a rooftop, had angles, and the fact that you went through kind of this concrete penetration hierarchy of first the anti-tank guided munition Matador, then the main gun of a tank, Apache Hellfire missiles, and then brought the D9 bulldozer in.
Yeah. You have to understand Sderot has been under constant rocket fire from 2006 onwards. So when they built the new police station, they had to make sure that it would enable the police to operate even during rocket attacks. That's why the building was so strong, so strongly built. And I must say that the contractor who built the police station did a great job. You can see pictures of the building standing on October 8th after being shot at with tanks, gunships, being bulldozed, and it's still mostly standing very strong.
Yeah, even the pictures, after you told me this and I saw the pictures of the final, like the building's still pretty much not flattened like you would think. So it started at 7:05 in the morning on October 7th, basically, when the three truckloads of Hamas showed up. And when did it officially end on the 8th?
I can't give you the exact hour, but I think that in early morning, they were able to make sure that there are no more terrorists around. Because throughout the night, I remember it being in the National Command Post for the police, we had reports of terrorists who succeeded breaking out of the station. And only in the morning, once there was light, they could make sure that this actually didn't happen and that there were no more living terrorists in Sderot. Now, the important thing to notice about the battle in the Sderot police station was that those 27 terrorists didn't get into Sderot just to take over the police station. That was their first stop. They planned after taking it over and neutralizing the police to continue throughout Sderot to murder, to terrorize, to kidnap. And the fact that the police officers responded so quickly and succeeded in preventing them from getting out of the station and from killing the police officers on the roof of the station actually prevented a far worse catastrophe than the one that happened there.
Right. It gets to the level of preparation that an intelligence gathering that Hamas did. They knew that the police station was the main protection of the city. So they were going to go there like they did in other places and take out the threat first so that they could systematically go about killing civilians along the way. Okay, I know we can't get through all of the events where the police are involved, but you have been working on a project, right? I want to ask you about the Black Arrow Monument, but I also want to ask you about how the police, especially you as the historian, has gone about recording the lessons. You walk me through the Battle of the Sherbrooke Police Station, hour, minute by minute, action by action. You walked me through the attack of Afikim and other places, but how have you as the historian gone about collecting the stories and doing the investigation, what happened at each location?
Well, beginning on October 7th at 7:20 in the morning, when we began getting the first clips from Sderot, actually, from the Sderot station, and we understood that there was something irregular going on, I began to record what was going on. And I spent a few days in the National Command Post. And from October 8th on, my team, the History and Heritage Unit for the police, and the Magav History Unit have been recording the stories of countless police officers. We have conducted more than 550 interviews with police officers of all ranks, from the commissioner, major generals, station commanders, and up to dispatch callers, patrol officers, and so on. In addition, we went through the command and control systems that the police use, which enable us to know who was where at what time. We've listened to the recordings of the radio network. We went over video cameras, recording, etc., and this enabled us to reconstruct police activities during that day. That's what we've been doing for the last year or so, and I believe that we have a very comprehensive picture of what the police did on October 7th. I wouldn't say 100% full picture, because you never get 100% with history, but I think that we can be very certain of the things that we think we know. We have a very good picture. We've actually recently published a book about the police activities on October 7th, and I hope to get the English version out shortly. And you can see there what our officers did throughout the day in more than 50 combat sites throughout the South District.
Yeah, I can't wait to get that book, because I visited, when was that? When it was in February. You were already working on even creating these video documentaries with avatars showing every location and vantage point where the terrorists got out, where people died and fell, and where the major battles was. It was amazing. And I know, having you already on the ranks as a historian, I don't have many historian friends. Jacob Stoyle, Jason Giroux, maybe one or other one, then you. But the sheer capability that you had within your team to immediately start collecting all those first-person interviews and then recreating the events of what was so much chaos in so many different locations. How many different locations are there that are in the book and that you recorded as police events?
In the book, we have, just a second, I'll tell you exactly.
Okay.
Okay, in the book, we have 26 distinct sites, although each site, of course, can be divided into different battle zones. But this is actually almost every community in the Gaza periphery zone, of course, the large towns and some of the areas on the road, the Nova Festival area. So there's hardly a place where there were attacks that day which we didn't have police officers operating.
I can't wait to read the book. Okay, I want to ask you about one other event while we have a few more minutes. But I also want to point out, because I didn't do it in the beginning, rockets starting around 6:30 in the morning, these Hamas trucks head straight into Sderot, three heading for the police station, and you mentioned, but I make it a point to discuss on October 7th, the methodical planning that one truck of Hamas broke off to establish an ambush just south of Sderot, and how many of the Hamas had that as their primary mission, military mission, to establish ambushes to seal all the different communities off in the Gaza envelope or the southern Israel so that nobody could come to anybody's aid.
Yeah, that was part of their modus operandi. And they've learned us very well. They knew that our security forces would respond to reports of attack by rushing to the aid of whomever was attacked. So they set ambushes on every junction in the area. And for example, on that junction near Sderot, they have been able to kill many civilians and even in the battle to clear that junction, five Yamam operators had been killed.
And I want people to understand, too, as somebody who's walked some of the equipment, we're not just talking about ambush figuratively. No, like professional ambush with heavy machine guns, anti-tank mines, anti-personnel mines, all established in an L shape or whatever, a parallel ambush with all the equipment.
They had camouflaging equipment. They dug in. They were very well prepared.
Okay. One last event, because for me, it's very almost synonymous with what happened on October 7th with so many different Israeli police, security forces, intelligence forces, you know, standing in the door. There's an event at the Black Arrow Memorial, which if anybody's ever been to Israel, and I had actually been by it on my way to visit Sehalim and other places. There's a memorial near Sarot, right along the border road that you can see Gaza from, that is a monument to the 1956 Sinai campaign and the paratrooper brigade. Something happens there, Shlomi, that for me sounds like almost like the hot gates of Thermopylae, the Spartans standing in a small place. But you started to tell me about it once, and I wonder if you could share.
Yes. So like you said, the memorial is very close to Gaza. It's actually on a low hill, which has a very good overview of the area. And it's, on the one hand, it's very close to Gaza. On the second hand, that's the main road running from north to south. And that's the best way to get deeper into Israel. And we now know that this was Hamas's staging point for the second wave of attack into Israel. So what happens is that about 10:30, we have a small team, five troopers from Magav, a special unit, on the way, on the road. They were on the way to the kibbutz of Kfar Aza. They have been called to assist there. And when they pass near the memorial, they encounter terrorists and begin fighting them. And then they are also joined by some army soldiers, and they confront the terrorists. Other small police forces arrive. You have to understand, this is about 10:30, 11 a.m. It's very chaotic. We have various units, various teams going to wherever they have been called to, and they just encounter those terrorists near the memorial on the way. They had no idea that there were terrorists in the memorial. They didn't know that Hamas is concentrating a very, very large force there. So they arrive, they find one, two, three terrorists, they take them out, and then they continue on their mission south. And at about that time, another small force of the Israel Police Special Unit, Unit 33, usually it's part of the regular police, not Magav, and it's a very, very capable unit to counter violent crime, and they also have secondary counter-terrorist capabilities. So one of the armored cars arrived there, and they see terrorists on the memorial, so they get in. It's a small jeep with four men, and they find themselves surrounded by dozens of terrorists. They get fired upon, they suffer two wounded, were very severely wounded, but luckily recovered since, and they got stranded on the memorial. So they had to call for assistance while they are fighting against, again, far, far larger enemy force. And at around 12 a.m., something like an hour and a half after those officers began fighting, another Yamam team arrives and they begin to engage the terrorists. They are joined by a small army unit. Eventually, also, gunship helicopter arrives, and for about an hour, they engage very, very large numbers of terrorists. I've seen an aerial photograph taken about 2 p.m. on October 7th, and it was partial, but I have been able to count more than 30 pickup trucks on the road leading from the memorial to Gaza. They have killed something between 200 to 300 terrorists on that area in a battle that took several hours. And again, this was accidental, and had those officers from Unit 33 not pursue terrorists into the memorial, there is a high probability that no one would have known that Hamas is trying to break out through the memorial until it would have been too late.
Yeah, and that's that the memorial, for, just for geography, is in that northeastern border area looking at Gaza. So had those 40 trucks or hundreds of Hamas gotten through the memorial, whether they went into Sirot or headed north, it could have been much more catastrophic than it already was. I've been there and how flat it is and how little cover it is. I think that story of this massive battle that's happening at the Black Arrow Memorial, literally like the hot gates of Thermopylae, that these small police and other units are holding all this off, is an amazing story I wanted to capture. But there are many other ones like the Nova Music Festival and others that I'm sure are in the book, and we'll get that book and I'll put it in the notes. And once it comes out in English, definitely interested in reading it. Well, thank you so much, Shlomi. Thank you for your time. Thank you for the story.
Thank you for having me, and keep up the good work.
All right. Thanks, brother. I'll talk to you later. Thanks for listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast. The podcast is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of their participants and do not represent the positions of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. You can subscribe to the Urban Warfare Project podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. And be sure to check out NWI's other podcasts, as well as the new articles we're publishing every day on our website. Thanks again for listening.